My special guest today is a remarkable man by any standard. He's a retired airline captain and former CIA contact pilot with over 19,000 hours of flight time, over 11,000 in command of three or four engine jet transports. He's flown over 100 different types of aircraft in 60 different countries around the world. He retired in 2001 after more than 40 years of flying. He flew secret missions for the CIA in Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa between 1967 and 1983. I'll be telling you more about him as the show proceeds. His name is John Lear. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's an honor to be here, Jim.
Well, it's a real great pleasure, and I should mention to our audience that we're going to talk about some controversial issues the first hour and some even more controversial issues the second. So you should strap themselves in for the duration. Now, I'm most interested initially, given your vast experience with aircraft, how it is that you have become convinced of the video fakery and even the possibility that there were no planes involved in the attacks on the Twin Towers.
It's three things. No parts.
Yeah, Colonel George Nelson, an Air Force colonel retired who was responsible for air crash investigation reviews, told me how there are, you know, hundreds, maybe even thousands of these time-sensitive, uniquely identifiable components in all these commercial carriers, and that from all four of the locations, not one of those parts was found.
That's right. There's 8.6 million parts. They're all serialized. They all have parts numbers on them. They have to be accountable. They're in the master record when Boeing puts these airplanes together. There's 300 miles of wiring. That's 60 miles each for the 757 and 90 miles each for the Boeing 767. Now, each wire is put together in a bundle, and when they put together in a bundle, they label every inch of that wire with the rating, where it comes from, and where it goes to. So if you ever have to work on it, when you take that bundle apart, all you have to do is find that particular number and then then trace it out and replace that wire. So we're talking about 300 miles of wire, and not one inch has shown up?
It's rather stunning. When you begin to, given all the other evidence we have, too, for example, that two of these aircraft were not deregistered with the FAA until 2002, and the other two not until 2005, we even had a report, John, of playing with that, the serial number of one of these aircraft being put up for sale. It wasn't quite on eBay, but it wasn't far removed from it, you know.
Yeah,
so, I mean, if you appreciate the enormity of the significance of this, I mean, look, vast numbers of people have to know this is a complete fraud just based upon this consideration alone.
That's correct. And the people that say, well, maybe they used a drone or remote control, it just doesn't wash for anybody who knows about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I want to turn to the other evidence related to the videos in a moment or two, but first I'd like to just ponder this. I mean, Boeing has to know, the FAA has to know, the national the NTSB has to know, the FBI has to know, the government in general, obviously, key players have to know. I mean, this is just a non-existence of evidence that had to be there if these scenarios involving these aircraft crashes were true. It's like walking into your living room and find no evidence of an elephant after you've been told there's one there. It's a case where the absence of evidence is evidence of absence.
Yeah, well, Boeing is used to playing games with the government, you know, and, you know, as far back as TW-800, we know that the Navy shot it down. It was accidentally shot down. They didn't do it on purpose, but the missile broke lock with the drone, and then when it required the lock, it acquired the 747 and went through the first class cabin and, blew it up, but they had to cover that up. So what they did is, they went to Boeing and they said, we want you to say that the center tank blew up because of arcing wires to the fuel pump. And Boeing said, well, that can't happen. I mean, there are no exposed wires. And they said, well, you need to say it anyway. And Boeing said, no, we're not going to do that. So the government thought about it for a couple of weeks, and then they came back and they said, well, how about this? How about you say that it was just the center tank of 100s, Boeing 747-100s, which nobody was flying anyway except, you know, cargo liners and old non-skids. And if you do that, if you say it was the arcing fuel pump, we will let you merge with McDonnell Douglas, which we know you've been trying to do for 8 years, but it's been tied up in antitrust suits in court. And so Boeing said, oh, okay, well, yeah, now that you mentioned that, yeah, I'll go along with that.
It's called bribery, John.
And so then when they went to TWA,
effing bribery. I mean, how outright can you get?
So they went to TWA and they said, we want to keep this quiet. And TWA said, no, we're, you know, on behalf of the passengers and employees, we want to take it to court. And they said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll make you a no interest $365 million loan that you don't have to pay back if you'll play ball. And TWA said, oh, okay, well, yeah, in that case, okay. So the only ones that lost out of this, you know, were the passengers and families got killed in this.
The passengers, but families, truth and justice.
Yeah.
You know, and one might as well say the American way, except
right.
What you're talking about. This degree of graft and corruption is all too typical of the way in which the government does business with American corporations.
That's the way they do the business.
It's so corrupt, John. You know, I'm getting to the point I'm ready to retch, to vomit over all the lies and deceit and deception. It's so grotesque.
Unfortunately, you don't know the half of it. I mean, the tenth of it. I mean, it is just out of control. People ask me, they say, well, look, you know, why did the government actually make this hoax of going into the World Trade Center? What was the point of that? And I tell them right out, look, the point of that was to find an excuse to go into Afghanistan because the Taliban were burning down the opium crops according to their religion. It was against the Quran. And we had to stop that because 80% of the world's economy runs on illegal drugs. And
Jesus.
We're the ones that do it. So what we had to do was...
We had to stop the Taliban from destroying the opium crops so the CIA could make its vast profits and dealing drugs.
So we went in there in 2001.
John,
opium,
staggering.
I'm not disagreeing
with you at all. Peter Dale Scott has done research on this subject and come up with very similar conclusions, you know, about the drug dealing by the
opium.
Agency.
Well, look, I've been in this, you know, since
for a while.
The laws. In 1972, I was a pilot over there for the agency. I know what's going on over there.
Yeah.
I didn't only drug myself, but I know that's what the war was about.
Yeah.
So in 2001, the production, opium production for Afghanistan was 14%. We go in there, we take over, we show them how to grow it, cultivate it, harvest it, sales and distribution so that we can use that money for our black projects. And guess what? New York Times says last August 2007 that they had now we're supplying 94% of the world's illegal drugs out of Afghanistan. It's a money-making business. That's where we get the money. And the people that pulled this off, the black ops, they need that money. And you know why? Because they don't want to go to Congress and tell Congress what they're doing for the money. They want to bypass Congress. They need cash to do the stuff that we're talking about.
And as Morgan has said, too, you needed the planes in order to have the hijackers. You needed the hijackers in order to have Arab terrorists. And you needed Arab terrorists to justify a phony war on terror.
Right.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, John Lear. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today has held 17 world records, including speed around the world in a Learjet Model 24 set in 1966. He was presented the PATCO, that's the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association Award for Outstanding Airmanship in 1968. He's a senior vice commander of the China Post 1 of the American Legion's Post for Soldiers of Fortune, a 25-year member of the Special Operations Association, and a member of Pilots for 9/11truth.org. It's a great pleasure to have him on the show, John Lear. John, just tremendous.
Thanks, Jim. You know, the other day I had an Air Force friend up here who flies B-1s, and he did it one-year tour in Afghanistan. And just kidding him, you know, I said, I bet you weren't able to bomb the Hindu Kush. He says, how did you know? And I said, you know, that's where they grow the opium there. He says, yeah. He says, that's a no-fly area. And I go to my commander and I say, why can't we bomb that? The Taliban's making all that money. You know, and I said, no, it's not the Taliban. It's us. We're the ones that harvest it. We're the ones distributed. He said, yeah, I wondered why that was a no-fly area.
Oh, God, John, this is so disgusting, so corrupt. I'll tell you, now listen, we're talking about the impossible speed, and I think all the points you're making in relation to that are impeccable. What ultimately convinced me, I found the most powerful argument, began with observations. I suspect they go back to Rosalie Grable, the web fairy, who observed how the plane seemed to melt into the building. And they have been refined somewhere between you and Morgan Reynolds and Joe Keith into observations about uniform motion, that this plane is moving in uniform motion through air and through a solid steel and concrete building, which of course is impossible, violates all three of Newton's laws. To me, this is as conclusive as an argument can get.
Yeah, first of all, when the nose hits, all those steel columns, box columns, were 14 inches on a side, and they were 39 inches on center. So let's say the nose hits, but then the two engines are going to hit, and then each wing is going to contact, you know, about 22 columns each. I mean, the first thing in a real crash that's going to happen is this tail is going to snap off.
Yeah.
Because the way a tail is attached to an airplane, it has vertical spars that attach to the aft fuselage bulkheads, and they go up to the top. It's not designed for a crash. So what I'm telling you is there's no carry-through structure that will hold that tail on. It'll just instantly snap off and crash against the building, and then parts will rain down. But like I said, there are no parts. There was no plane.
Yeah. That, well, and then the next point I would make is, you know, you're seeing the plane as it melts through the building, and you're not seeing it create the kind of cutout that you subsequently appears. In other words, while the cause is creating the effect is not present when it should be present.
Yeah, and then they released that Purdue University, and you know, Purdue worked, they did that ridiculous Pentagon one, and then they did the one on the World Trade Center, and they have the 15-foot diameter fuselage sitting between 12-foot floors, you know, and they have the cores represented as matchsticks. I mean, the whole thing was a joke.
They perpetrate a similar absurdity down at the Pentagon in the study of the support structures. I guess they're all purpose utility, infielder, outfielder. If you need some phony data, go to Purdue.
Yeah, that's where you go.
It's really embarrassing. Yeah. And then, of course, you have the point that Morgan has made repeatedly, which is closely related to what you're talking about, parts. You should have parts of the plane just crumpled in these crash sites. You know, they should be all over the place, below the building, in the wedged into the crack and all that stuff. I mean, it's nice, clean, and tidy, and there are no parts.
And they're all identifiable. If they don't have a serial number, they have a mark on it that will tell you it was from a Boeing 67. Every rivet is identified like that. Every piece, every part in an airplane has to meet conformity. And it has to be built somewhere that has to be approved by the FAA. It has to be built by someone who's approved by the FAA. And it has to be identified as a part that belongs specifically to the 767, and when it goes down the production line, all of this goes in a record. So it's easy to trace all this. That engine that landed on Murray Street has been identified by somebody as a CFM-56. CFM is a Senecma engine, which is a General Electric company. And they say, oh, yeah, this is the one that came flying off 175. Okay, well, CFM-56 is a DC-8 engine used on Boeing 737s.
Yes, it's the wrong kind of plane.
All engine.
You look at that, John, the way it's sitting there on the concrete. I mean, it's like it was just laid there gently. It didn't come down with great velocity and shatter the sidewalk.
Okay, then somebody said, well, how about, you know, Senecma also made the CF-6, which is a Boeing 767 airplane. And so you could allow that, yes, maybe there were some parts that did belong to the CF-6, but the problem is United Airlines, which the engine allegedly came off, was using specifically Pratt & Whitney's, the other Boeing 767. So whose ever job
it was. What a shame. This is like all the calls that were made with airphones that Boeing hadn't yet installed in these aircraft. It's really amazing.
So whoever was supposed to drop off that engine picked up the wrong one.
Right.
Picked up the one from American and not the one.
Right. You know, I got a lawyer in Columbus who has been tracing this one very interesting piece of debris from a 757 on the Pentagon lawn, which they moved around and photographed from different perspectives. And he has found that it came from a crash in Calais, Colombia in 1995.
Yeah, the problem was the zinc chromate color wasn't the color they used when they originally built that 757. It didn't match up.
That's very nice. He even found a part of the vine that is ensnared in it, the kind of vine that's used to make wicker furniture, that ripped it off when it was when it crashed. I mean, this is really stunning stuff.
It's amateur night.
They seem to have a warehouse of all this this garbage that they can just dump out whenever they need something to fake the public.
Yeah.
Shocking, stunning. How gullible are we, John? I mean, you know, let me ask you this one, too. Simon Shack appears to have been the first to have noticed how, in the footage, you see the nose actually coming out the opposite end of the building, and it's essentially basically intact, which obviously, given the nose is the most fragile part of one of these aircraft loaded with sensitive electronics, couldn't possibly happen if it were authentic.
Not going through the 47-box column core there. He quit himself by 36. But, you know, one of the first things when 9/11 happened, when an airplane takes off, the last thing that happens when they close the door is the envelope goes out the door. And
yeah.
The gate agent handles that. And so if there's a crash, NTSB says, we want to see the envelope. We want to see it right now. Because that tells you, number one, that the captain certified that he had enough fuel, that the airplane was in weight and balance, and it also contains the last maintenance sheet. In other words, you know, no matter what they did at that stop, the maintenance sheet has got to be signed off by the, you know, by the mechanics saying the airplane is fit to fly, and also it has a list of the passengers. That's the envelope. So, four airplanes, where's the envelope for any of them?
No envelopes.
No envelopes.
It's absolutely stunning. You know, an Icelandic scholar named Elias Davidson has just published a piece entitled, you know, explain how there's no evidence that any hijackers were aboard any of these aircraft. And, of course, it's perfectly consistent with everything you're saying. In fact, these planes seem to have had a rather phantom-like existence.
Well, let's go to the first thing that they talk about, the hijackers taking over the cockpit. Okay, now they've got their box knives, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Box cutters, yeah.
Okay, they're box cutters. Okay,
yeah.
Jim, how are they going to kill the pilots? You tell me.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, John Lear. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today says he became a no-planer after realizing the technical impossibility of many of the aspects of the generally accepted hijacker story, which we've been reviewing in our conversation already today. He was also briefed, he's also been briefed by two retired Lockheed Martin scientist engineers on the status of secret state-of-the-art holographic projections, which he was told project real-time solid images with light, heat, and sound onto thin air. John, he believes the only reason people are plane huggers is they are technologically ignorant, I might add scientifically illiterate. And if they could be briefed on state-of-the-art high-tech, they would graduate to no-planer status. My guest, John Lear. Fascinating stuff, John.
Scientifically illiterate. Can I use that one?
Of course.
Okay. Now
it describes 95% of the American population.
Absolutely.
Part of the reason they can get away with all this happy horse shit, you know.
That's right.
We saw many fantastic things on television, John. Tens of thousands of hours. We watch all these programs with fantasies.
You know, Arthur C. Clarke said it best when he said, you know, about the technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. And that's what we're looking at.
Yeah, that's right. I remember one of the commentators almost immediately said that, you know, when the plane went into the building, he said it looked like a special effect on a bad movie. And I think he was just trying to apologize. You know, it was as though that was what it should look like, a special effect in a bad movie.
Right.
Completely ridiculous. Well, I'm interested in this holographic business. You think, see, I mean, I've become rather convinced that there's this 17-second delay between real-time events and their broadcast that gave the opportunity to introduce, footage of the planes approaching the building, integrate, you know, real footage of the buildings with this prepared footage about the planes. Ace Baker's been particularly good in the study of this. Now, when you mention holograms, of course, Rosalie Grable has made that claim from the beginning, but I've never known there was actually evidence to substantiate it.
Absolutely. They've had it for about 20 years, and I sat down with this Lockheed scientist, lives in Los Altos Hills, about a year ago, and I said, I won't tell you his name, and we'll call him Bill.
Yeah.
I said, Bill, I'm beginning to think they used a hologram for these airplanes. He says, well, let me tell you a story. He said, just before I retired from Lockheed, he said, I was driving to work down at Sunnyvale, And they said, I had a friend of mine, and we're going down the Bayshore Freeway, and he said, we saw a shadow, and we looked up, he said, not 200 feet over the car is this huge Boeing 747. He said, we were just stunned because it, you know, it was going the wrong way to go into San Francisco, and it certainly wasn't going to San Jose.
Yeah.
And he said, we watched it for about 15 seconds, and he said, it just went out like it was a light. It just snapped out. And he said, that was my first look at an honest to God homicide.
The image just disappeared in the air because they shut it off or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just projected into thin air, and people have so much problem with that. On the web, you know, people say they can't, they needed something to project it against. I said, no, they project it into thin air. That's technology that's 30 or 40 years ahead of what you think. That's why we're calling them scientifically illiterate, because you just cannot get them to see what could happen. Okay, so the next guy I talked to is a Lockheed engineer that lives in New Mexico that worked with the hologram at a project down in Alamogordo. And he said, John, he said, we can project an image, solid image, with heat, light, and sound, he said, right into thin air. He said, you wouldn't be able to, you know, tell the difference.
Uh-huh.
And the guys on the web, you know, they have so much trouble with the sound because they say, well, what did they do? Drive speakers along the street? You know?
I know.
They're like, no, the holographic self contained the sound. Now, let me tell you one quick story. A lady came to visit me about 2 years ago. She's in the casting business, which my wife is. My wife was a movie actress at one time, and she's been in casting for many, many years. And this lady came out from New York, and we were talking about holograms. And she says, well, let me tell you something. And also, let me tell you, this lady has 2 degrees from Harvard, and one of them is astrophysics. She's an amazing lady.
Yeah.
Anyway, she says, I would invite her down to Hollywood for a preview of the future of television. And we go into this real nice little theater. It, you know, only held about like 50 people. It was very plush, very comfortable, and there were very high-level television executives there. This, she said, this happened in about 7 or 8 years ago, would have made it about the year 2000. So she said, we're sitting there, and it's brightly lit, and from behind the stage comes a middle European gentleman with a thick accent. He had a white shock of hair. He comes up to the podium and he starts telling us about the history of television, how they developed it, how they invented the cathode ray tube, and how it was developed by Westinghouse. And then they came to color. And she says, frankly, it was a boring, you know, kind of a boring thing because she already knew this. But as the guy talked, he would step off the stage, come and walk up the aisle, take off his glasses, clean his glasses, then he'd go back down in front of the podium and lean against and talk to him, and then he'd go around to the end of the stage and come back up to the podium, and after about 20 minutes of this boring kind of lecture, he said, thank you, and disappeared. And so what this was showing, that 7, 8 years ago, the future of television, we won't need a screen. You'll just turn it on, and the actors will be right in your room. And you can make
this with a holographic man giving a lecture?
Yeah. It was in a bright... It was a bright thing. And if we had that technology 8 years ago, you know, the military had it 30 years before that.
Yeah.
So the people the people that think of, in terms of holographs, of a pixie dancing in an ice cube in a dark room at Disneyland, don't have the faintest idea what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what would be the source? Where would the projection originate from?
In the case of the World Trade Center, the
E4.
The Boeing 747 that was flying.
Oh, okay. So it would be projected from the plane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Plane,
and it's, I think it's a 360 degree phenomenon. It's three dimensional, and it can even come with sound.
Absolutely, it's just like it was there, Jim. It was just like an airplane. So the only problem is, they couldn't fake the strobe lights. And every airplane has to turn on their strobe lights before takeoff, night and day, and it has to be on from takeoff to landing, and it has to flash 60 to 84 times a minute. And in every video I've looked, there's not one flash because it's a fake.
Well, I think this is another very powerful argument, the missing strobe lights. I think
there's
that's
no
a wonderful
strobe
point, John.
Go out to the airport and look in the daytime and see how bright those things are.
Yeah.
On the film, it should have picked up, you know, at least 3 or 4 strobes, but there's nothing there.
Yeah. Listen, I've been asked to show you an image of the towers where you can see fires across the whole floor. I've just sent it to you. If you get a chance to look at your email, okay. You can take a look at it during the break, and I want to ask you about it when we come back. But I also want to talk about other things. Before we before we get there to the break, however, what do you think Americans need to understand to put all this together? They don't have access to your experts on holographic projection. What do you take as the strongest evidence? I mean, they were projecting the image, obviously, at too fast a velocity, at too an impossible speed. It was passing through the building in an impossible fashion. It wasn't leaving the parts and residue that would be necessary if it were real. So we know whatever's going on there, it's faked. It's either video fakery per se, or authentic video of a faked image. It seems to be coming down to that.
I don't know. I'm not an expert on holography, but I do know it exists, and I'm sticking with. I'm leaning towards that. At least one of those was a holographic image.
Yeah. By the one the South Tower hit, maybe the North too, maybe American 11.
Yeah.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest John Lear. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stick around. My special guest today has an extraordinary background. He's a remarkable man by any standard. He's a retired airline captain, former CIA contract pilot with over 19,000 hours of flight time, over 11,000 in command of three or four engine jet transports. He's flown over 100 different types of aircraft in 60 different countries around the world. He retired in 2001 after more than 40 years of flying. He flew secret missions for the CIA in Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa between 1967 and 1983. His name is John Lear. John, again, a pleasure to welcome you on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jim. And I want to cover that pilot thing because I know that people need to know about this hijacker story, and it couldn't possibly be true. So let me ask you, if you had a box cutter and you go into the cockpit, how are you going to kill the pilot? I know you haven't probably killed any pilots lately. But let's say you're the hijacker and you're going to go in there and you want to take that airplane over, so how are you going to do it?
Yeah. What, are you going to threaten to cut his throat? I mean, that would seem to be the...
No, you're going to have to cut his throat because he's not going to get out of that seat, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so what my point is, once the blade goes through the carotid artery, there is going to be more blood pumping in that cockpit than you can imagine.
The
problem is, he's going to have to get the other guy to the co-pilot.
Yeah.
So now he's got two hearts pumping blood over the cockpit.
Yeah, slippery, oily, messy.
Now, if he wants to sit in that seat, he's going to have to get the guy out. So he has to undo his seatbelt. He has to put the seat, electrical or mechanical, roll it back, and then he has to pull him out. And, of course, there's no place in the companionway, so he's going to have to take him in the cabin, and then he's going to have to sit down there. And believe me, it's not going to be a pretty sight. There's going to be blood over the wheel, over the instruments. I mean, it's going to be all over the place. Now you're telling me that a hijacker is going to be able to read that EFIS, which is the electronic flight instrumentation system, and fly that thing back to New York with all this blood? It's not going to happen. It couldn't happen. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So, What a mess.
What a mess. You know, and there's not that many towels on airplanes, you know, and it's going to be messy and it's going to be sticky and... And all I can say, if it happened, it was quite a feat of airmanship.
I think you make a lot of excellent points about the preposterousness of it all. Am I wrong to think that video fakery would be compatible with real planes, or, of course, with no planes at all, or with holograms, if there were features of the planes they wanted to conceal or of their interaction with a building? I mean, granted, what we see on the video is fake. Does it necessarily follow that there were no planes?
Yes.
The reason being?
There were no planes.
But how do we make the linkage between the video fakery and to the inference there were no planes?
I don't know about that.
Yeah. But Morgan, one of the great pleasures of being in this position is I deal with a lot of brilliant people like you and Morgan Reynolds and Judy Wood and Jerry Liepart and Ace Baker, and it's such a pleasure to have the opportunity to have these conversations with you. So, sometimes, of course, you have differences of opinion about one point or another, which suggests that since you all fall into this category, you know, brilliant people aren't always right. Sometimes if you have a conflict, one of you must be wrong. Now, Morgan's raised the question here that if a plane image was projected over a Manhattan, then it would have to arrive before the CGI video fakes, CGI, oh, computer-generated image video fakes. Separate times would be needed, is that right? Or would it be too hard to delete or disguise? If you can make sense of this question, he's also saying holograms would be literally filmed and there'd be no computer-generated images. Does there need to be a reconciliation of computer-generated image, video fakery, and holographic projection? But, you know, I suggested before you could be filming the holograms. Is that your opinion of what was taking place?
You know, I'm going to have to give this some thought because Morgan sent me the same email. And
yeah.
We're going to have to sit down and give this some real serious thought.
Yeah. Well, it's extremely interesting. And, you know, it's just such a pleasure for me to be dealing with people of your quality that it's it just makes life extremely interesting. But we have a caller from Los Angeles who'd like to raise a question. In fact, his name is Mike in L.A. Mike, you're welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
Hey, Jim. How's it going?
Real good. How are you?
Good. Hey, John, I'm a big fan, my friend.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
I'm good, man. I try to catch you on any podcast, any clip of I Google your name frequently just to see where you've been, man. So. Hey, I sent Jim a picture of the tower. I don't know if you got a chance to check your email.
Yeah, I've been looking at it.
Okay, what is that line?
Boy, I'll tell you, you got me.
And how could that be natural or random, John?
Let me just describe it now. What we're looking at is that, let's see, how many floors down? Looks like about 20 floors down. Where there's a whole floor that is a fire, and it's a very uniformly distributed. It's not what you would expect, of course, if this had been from the distribution of jet fuel, fire, anything. It's so uniformly across the floor that is what I think raises questions about it. Would you agree, John, Mike?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just so unnatural.
We need to get Morgan in on this.
Yeah.
Well, there we have an odd one. I want to keep Mike on here for a minute or two because there's a more controversial issue that John has strong opinions, and I think that Mike would have some question about him. To wit, John, you have views about the moon and the possible use of the moon for military purposes. Is that correct?
Yeah, it goes much deeper than that. When you talk about video fakery and people say, oh, you know, the military couldn't fake this. You know, they faked Apollo. We never went to the moon. It was a hoax. It
yes.
never happened. And we were doing this, you know, 35 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they have a lot of practice on doing this. And there's good, honest, loyal Americans who honestly think we went to the moon. And we didn't. It was a hoax. That's why Neil Armstrong shuttered himself for 30 years, hasn't said a word. You know, that's why Buzz Aldrin acted the way he did. I mean, it did not happen. It was hoaxed. We never went there.
Yeah.
So they have practiced doing this stuff. Now, whether they went to the moon or not, you know, it's up in the air.
Hey, John, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Does our Department of Defense or NASA do they, and now this is man-to-man a question right here, just straight man instincts. Do they act like a government who has achieved a goal that they've gone to the moon? Is their posture of a government that has achieved something, like achieving a new road or building a new bridge or finding, do they act like they went to the moon?
I'm not sure what you're getting.
No, I'm saying, is their posture that of a person who went to the moon? Like,
well,
your dad created the Learjet, and the posture of his life,
let me slow that down just one sec, Mike. I mean, I think part of what you're asking is, do the astronauts who allegedly walked on the moon act as though that was something they had actually done and they're proud about? I mean, to the moon, you couldn't shut me up. These guys seem very reluctant to even address the issue, as they've been known to assault persons who asked them to put their hand on a Bible and swear they'd gone to the moon.
Yeah, exactly. They're,
yeah, the
they
posture isn't, you know, of people that have achieved something.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, John Lear. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is the son of Learjet inventor Bill Lear. He holds more FAA airman certificates than any other FAA-certified airman. These include the airline transport pilot certificate with 23 type ratings, flight instructor, flight engineer, flight navigator, ground instructor, aircraft dispatcher, control tower operator, parachute rigger, and mechanic, rated for both airframe and power plant. John, you've had an impressive career.
Hey, thanks, Jim. I wanted to mention two books here about what we were talking about.
Yeah.
One is Dark Mission,
yeah.
Secret History of NASA. Was written by Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra. That gives a real good outline of how NASA was formed and who ran it. The other book is called Dark Moon, the Apollo and the Whistleblowers. It's 570 pages long, and the first 380 pages are how they faked Apollo.
Yeah.
How they faked the Apollo mission.
Yeah, fascinating.
Really,
I want to mention three videos that I think are quite good. One is called Conspiracy Theory, Did Man Go to the Moon? Now, for some reason, this has become extremely scarce, but it must have two dozen really excellent arguments, you know, from the Van Allen radiation belt, the flimsy character of these so-called spacesuits, the fact that lunar lander couldn't even be operated successfully in the much more intense gravitational field of Earth, much less on the moon, and yet everything goes absolutely flawlessly. The way in which the lander takes off from the moon's surface as though it's being jerked upward by a crane. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's really spectacular, but very difficult to find. The second is something called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, the most interesting aspect of which is when they're showing the image of the Earth from space, and they pull back, and you discover that the image of the Earth is created by a portal inside the space vehicle. And a point that Mike is going to want to make when he gets back on the air here with us is that it's the Earth is much too small. I mean, you got a very small Earth. And there are a lot of geographical arguments, geometrical arguments that suggest that what's going on here is fraudulent. And then a third is called Moon Movie. You can get it right now if you just click on moonmovie.com on Google. This new moon movie, one of the great things about the moon movie, it's very, very elegant. It gives a minimal number of arguments to lay the foundation for the inescapable conclusion that we did not go to the moon. The most interesting one of which, in my opinion, is that Wernher von Braun led an expedition to Antarctica to collect moon rocks, which had been dislodged from the moon by the impact of asteroids and captured by the Earth's gravitational field, which made it possible for them to produce actual bona fide moon rocks as evidence that we'd actually gone to the moon.
Yeah, those are all excellent points. And one thing that people don't know about that lunar lander, all of the guys were in, you know, for hours on end, you know, Apollo 11 allegedly in there for 15 hours and all the rest more than that. You know, there were no seats, there were no couches, and they stood up for takeoff, and all they had was a bus strap on the top to hold on to. Now, I just read Jim Irwin's book about taking off, and he says our acceleration was 5,000 feet a second. Well, that's 3,400 miles an hour, and they're holding on with a bus strap?
Mike's got a couple of questions like that he put to an expert on the field. Mike, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
You remember when you were there and you presented those questions? Could you explain that scenario? Because I think you were right on the money.
Yeah, what I was asking, John, is Professor Tyson DeGrasse. He's a professor at the museum. And I was asking him, how far away is the moon? And he tells me, you know, it's a quarter of a million miles away. And I said, how long did it take to get there? 3 days. How fast are they going? 25,000 miles an hour. I said, okay, wait. Let's do that again. How far away? And even he got stumped, Jim, because he realized instantly 25,000 miles an hour, even if you only went 25,000 miles an hour for 8 hours, there's something wrong with the math. When
yeah,
you go
400,000 miles, which is way past the moon.
Exactly.
Isn't that a nice, elegant argument, John, that, you know, they claim they took 3 days, but they're going so fast they should have been there in 10 hours.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Even 24 hours, John, wouldn't you say? Even 24 hours they should have been there.
Yeah.
So the guy had to admit to Mike, he said, yeah, your math is correct.
Yeah, now I did. There's a video going around that somebody posted just recently of the astronauts getting out of the helicopter on the Hornet. And, you know, they were in space 8.1 days, and it's only 1 hour. It took them 63 minutes for the helicopter to pull them out of the space capsule. And when they get to, when they land on the deck of the Hornet, there's four steps there, and the video is of him bouncing down these steps and walking across the deck into the into the quarantine module. Now, don't you think after 8 days in space,
wow,
you'd be just a little bit tiny wobbly? But pull that up and look at it.
You couldn't even stand up straight, John. You couldn't even stand up straight.
That's true, John. That's a very good point.
Pull
the equilibrium
thing up, it's
everything
all over
would be
the web. It's extremely interesting. Now, if you'll go to thelivingmoon.com, that's a website that I contribute in and partly work with. We have a lot of how they hoax the Apollo mission there, and what we have is pictures of the 20-foot moon at Langley Research Center that they used to fake the landings. And,
well, let me mention two other things. One is that you can also go online and go to Moon Movie. You'll find Moon Landing Hoax. So they give 10 reasons why, how you can prove that we didn't go to the moon. That's right there also on Google. And another resource that I think is, you know, it's a Hollywood production, but then if we're right, so was the were those moon landings. It's called Capricorn 1, about a trip to Mars and how it was faked from a set out in the Mojave Desert. It's really quite brilliant, absolutely brilliant film. And I think when you have a single grainy feed, it would be very easy to do what is represented there in terms of deceiving the public.
Yeah, I think NASA did that themselves, you know, just to, they're so clever in the way they pulled this off. They've thought of, you know, almost everything. I mean, they're very clever on this.
Yeah. Mike, you want to squeeze another question?
I was going to ask John. John, in every picture, the horizon's always 50 to 100 feet behind the guys. And I was always wondering, where can you duplicate that on Earth, where the Earth's horizon is always right behind you?
At the Langley Research Center. That's where
that's the only place you can do that, because
the Langley Research Center.
Again, that math is impossible. If the Earth, I mean, if the moon is the size of the United States, then there's nowhere. I mean, you can't see the horizon in the United States just standing outside in your front yard.
Yeah, there's many questions.
Mike, I want to thank you for calling. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back with my special guest, John Lear. My special guest today has held 17 world records, including speed around the world in a Learjet Model 24 set in 1966. He was presented the PATCO, Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association Award for Outstanding Airmanship in 1968. He's a senior vice commander of the China Post 1, the American Legion Post for Soldiers of Fortune, a 25-year member of the Special Operations Association, and a member of Pilots for 9/11 Truth. .org. He's a brilliant guy, and I'm very happy to have him on the show. His name, in case you haven't noticed, is John Lear.
Hey, thanks, Jim.
I got to say, John, you know, it seems to me that there's really a public service to be performed by talking about the moon landing hoax, because it's being used as a kind of a psychological club on anyone who takes, a position at variance with a public opinion, especially when public opinion is based upon ignorance and a lack of scientific knowledge.
Yeah, I'm so delighted that you gave me scientifically illiterate, because I'm adding it to my technologically ignorant.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, we got another caller on the phone. If I'm not mistaken, his name is Morgan, and he's from Little Rock.
Hey, good afternoon.
What do you say, Morgan, my friend?
Hey, and that's from Arkansas. I'm actually in Hot Springs.
Okay, Hot Springs. Thank you for correcting me.
Hey, I wanted to comment on a couple things there where Mike sent in the picture, which I'm not only 99% sure, but I think that's the south side of Tower 1, and it showed this ramrod straight fire on a certain floor. It looked to be, it's like floor 105 or thereabouts.
It could be. It's about 20, somewhere 10 or 15 down, maybe 20,
And from Mike's call, I agree with him. It sounds like he's pointing out, hey, this looks like a fuel rod in my Weber propane grill, right? I mean, it is so contrived. It wouldn't be the product of an airplane crash into a tower.
Yeah.
And This triggers a related thought, and that is, you know, Dr. Judy Wood, the PhD engineer, talks about smudge pots.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was, it's just these things are belching all this charcoal smoke, dark gray, and that appeared to be synthetic, too. It wasn't that these were oxygen star fires, as many observed years ago.
Well, you know, Morgan, and we've discovered that the billowing black smoke from the Pentagon was coming from a series of enormous dumpsters.
Yes, yes, and that persisted. They let it run for 48 hours. Drive home the point now, didn't they?
Wasn't that ridiculous?
But this goes to the whole point that this was a magic show. And while we can conjecture and maybe not prove every aspect of it, it was a show. It was a psyop from start to finish. And Mike's picture restores or renews that view again.
I think you and I and John and Mike all agree about that. Now, I'm kind of fascinated to take advantage of this opportunity to talk a bit more about the moon hoax. You have offered on occasion some what I thought were just simply incisive arguments about the relative size of the Earth in relation to the moon, that the proportions are simply all wrong. And it seems to me arguments like that plus, geometrical analysis in terms of the curvature shown in photographs, it can be quite revealing, although there are, of course, the features of photographs by virtue of the lens and the light and so forth that can distort or exaggerate curvature.
Yeah, there's so many things wrong, and I'm going to sell something here that I have no financial stake in, and that is, you pointed to the moonmovie.com website.
Right.
Bart Cybrell has, I own this, four videotapes, maybe of their DVDs available now, that are so great, where he goes around and asks the astronauts to swear on the Bible that he's carrying.
Oh, yeah, he's the one who nearly got bonked.
Right, right. And
listen, Morgan, send me contact information on this guy, and I'll put him on the show, and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, Bart Cybrell would be a good guest.
If you'll send me a link and so forth. Is there anything you'd like to ask John or remark in addition about understanding the moon landing
business?
Well,
yeah, two more remarks, let me go one more sentence on Cybrell. And that
sure.
is one of the great episodes is with the press conference. And Neil Armstrong has got all this angst that John pointed out, how he laid low for 30 years. And he is the most, he ruined his life.
These guys aren't guys who grew up to live a lie, and yet that's been what they've been required to do, and no doubt under orders, military orders.
Yeah, John, maybe correct me, but it wasn't Buzz. One of the three I really didn't like, and it might have been Buzz Aldrin, and he was just, you tell me, John, I can't remember the name of the third astronaut, but one of them, he's just a bad personality, and he's the kind of guy that this fraud wouldn't bother him to participate.
Buzz Aldrin was in on it from the beginning, and he's now president of one of the major contractors for NASA on some of the new rockets we got going. Now, Mike Collins was the third astronaut, and he's the one that allegedly stayed in the command service module.
Yeah, it's Aldrin, the guy I don't like.
Gus Grissom is the kind of guy who would never have put up with any of this malarkey, so they toasted him in a dry run.
Okay,
yeah,
January 27th, 1967, it was 2 weeks after Gus made the statement. He said, this thing ain't going to go to the moon in 2 years. This thing ain't going to the moon in 10 years.
Yeah.
And so they had to kill him. I've heard insiders from NASA say, well, you know, we didn't actually kill him, but we let it happen.
Shit.
And mm-hmm. There was a fourth mm-hmm. astronaut in the down by the EVM thing, down where they had the moon rocks where they were going to load them. And the fourth astronaut was always helping them sort the problems out. And what's his name? I can't remember his name. The guy that was supposed to be there took off that day, and they had one of the secret astronaut corps down in there helping him, and he got... killed too, and
there were three of them in the capsule at the time. Yeah,
there was four of them.
Four of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was
secret
loaded with pure oxygen.
Pardon?
It was loaded with pure oxygen.
Yeah, and they had Gussum or Grissom,
Grissom,
White, and Chaffee, and
yeah.
then the fourth astronaut was in there, and when the fire came, the NSA, which actually runs everything, National Security Agency, shut everything down, went in there, took the body out, and took him 45 minutes to get him out from under the astronauts, and then they put him in a body bag, and then they let NASA come in and resume, you know, the normal operations there. Now, the secret...
You know, you're saying this fourth astronaut was a secret. He wasn't supposed to be known to be present.
Right. Now, let me ask you this, Jim. How many astronauts do you think we have now that are current and qualified?
Half a dozen, maybe. Maybe none. None.
4,700 between the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. Hey, just look it up on Space Command.
47? What in God's name would we do with 4,700 astronauts?
Well, because we have at least 12 orbiting weapons platforms.
Maybe we want to make a human bridge to the moon. They're just going to stand on each other's shoulders.
If you're wondering when the space shuttle launches, why it takes 3 days always to catch up with the International Space Station, you might look back in 1981 and say, you know, in 20 years, can't we launch? You know, it only takes 9 minutes to get to orbit. Why can't we ever catch up with the ISS? Well, the joke is, what they're doing is they're stopping at each weapons platform and gets, you know, unloading fruits, vegetables, food, and then when we get to the International Space Station, the Russians have always sent, already sent two rockets up, and they unload that food onto the space station, and then when the space shuttle undocks, it always takes 2 days to get back. Now, you know,
we'll be right back with my special guest. We have a simply marvelous guest on today, a truly extraordinary man with a remarkable career, a retired airline captain, former CIA contract pilot with over 19,000 hours of flight time, 11,000 in command of 3 or 4 engine jet transports. He's flown over 100 different types of aircraft in 60 different countries. He's held 17 world records, including speed around the world in a Learjet Model 224 set 1966. A fascinating guy, and I want to pick up with this point, John, you were making about the use of NASA to be the covert agency for the weaponization of space. And I just want to follow this up by observing that I had Bob Bowman on this show about 18 months ago, maybe 2 years. And I was asking him, since he had been the former director of the Star Wars research program under Carter and Ford, about the weaponization of space, and he simply hemmed and hawed about it. He didn't want to address it. Now, I don't know if he needed clearance, because later he started talking about the militarization of space and how the Star Wars program was always offensive, never defensive, which, of course, implies putting these weapons in space. And now it's very clear from the remarks you're making that NASA has been the agency that's been actually, I guess, an agency within the agency, actually performing the deed of putting all these weapons in space. And I presume that this is your conclusion, too, and therefore I want to ask you whether you think any of these could have been involved in the destruction of the Twin Towers.
Well, absolutely. It was that's who did it. We did it from space. It was a direct energy weapon. If you're wondering how all those astronauts that I told you about get up, all you have to do is Google Reagan test site and go to the Ronald Reagan ballistic missile defense test site at Kwajalein Island. That's where all the operations come out of. I mean, there's so much going on there. It's unbelievable.
Really?
But yes, we did that from a direct energy weapon from a, my opinion, from an orbiting weapon station. And as the shuttle has more or less been covered, you know, we send up 8 astronauts who spend, you know, 10 days up there 4
yeah.
times a year. I mean, we have so much stuff going on up there, people would be absolutely mind-boggled. Now, the International Space Station, you'll notice closely that any photograph from a space station is very narrow. It never covers the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
There's so much going on up there, and so they have to be careful not to catch any, you know, any other operations.
Yeah.
But just look at any one of those great big beautiful pictures they have, and look how many doors they have, you know, for the different types of spaceships to hook up there.
Uh-huh. So that's going to be where a staggering amount of our defense budget is going.
Absolutely.
Could it be related to the missing $2.3 trillion? I presumed a whole lot of that went to Israel for whatever reason, or involved buying up mass media corporations and all that sort of thing. I've been trying to sort out what was done with that stunning sum of money.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I know that the money is missing, and I know that, Rumsfeld was going to make the announcement, the day before?
He did make it the day before, on a Monday, too, no less, which, of course, an experienced politician would never do, knowing the reporters are going to dog you all week and it's going to grow legs. It's as though he knew something was going to intervene, obliterate the $2.3 trillion from consciousness, and he'd be able to waltz into the halls of Congress the next day and ask for hundreds of billions more in defense spending, which is exactly what happened.
Now, if you want to get some pictures of these really neat weapons platforms, we have, just go to Google and Google FAST, and some guy has spent a lot of time with a 10-inch telescope and getting pictures of the desert, and they're just spectacular. I mean, just take a look at these pictures of these weapons platforms we got. They're just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I'm going to FAST. Fuel air spark technology, is that part of what this is about?
Let me see if I can find one while we're talking here.
Yeah.
At last resort, you could go to thelivingmoon.com, and we've got the videos on there. But
thelivingmoon.com.
Yeah. Thelivingmoon.com.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, John, it's such a pleasure to have someone like you with your experience and background who's willing to speak so candidly and so analytically about these matters. I mean, the American people, it seems to me, are entitled to truth, and the whole country has been living this history of lies. I mean, the assassination of JFK, the moon landing. I mean, you don't have to go back to these trivialities like the Gulf of Tonkin, which is child's play. Or getting the ambassador's daughter in to tell Congress how the Iraqi soldiers were dumping babies out of incubators onto the concrete floor to die. I mean, all this stuff is cheap rubbish. But when we talk about, you know, a gigantic hoax on the order of JFK or the moon landing, or now, of course, going, you know, this war on terror, I mean, the American people need nothing more than the simple truth.
They're not going to get it. Listen, did you type in thelivingmoon.com?
Yes.
Okay, are you on the first page?
I'm on the Google page, and I don't know where to go from there. Oh, the Living Moon. There, okay, I see one. Oh, there you go. I see your name. Yeah, okay, good. That's you.
Okay, now wait. You want to go to the original page. Cause
I'm on the Living Moon, the Enigmas on the Moon, your photo on the left, and I take it Ron Schmidt on the right.
Now, see that picture there?
What a beautiful picture, but the Earth is way too small, is it not?
Okay, do you see that blue thing there?
Yeah.
Okay, now, forever, any photo that we've been given of the moon, which is very few, if you look at a full moon, on the left-hand side of the moon, about the 10 o'clock position, is a crater called Aristarchus. And on any picture you see, it'll be whited out. And any time anybody asks NASA about it, they say, oh, it's a white material, we don't know what it is. I had a photographer...
Oh, you mean the center of, on the left, it looks like a volcano coming up there.
Okay.
Is that what we're talking about? Was very bright white?
The very bright lights. It's a nuclear reactor. I had that photo taken by a 10-inch telescope by a friend of mine in UK. And what you see, that blue glow, that's a Cherenkov effect. And what that is, what causes that is when radiation hits air. That causes that. And if you look at that dome very carefully, it's 29 miles in diameter.
Oh, you're talking about 10 o'clock. You're talking about near about an inch in from the circumference. Am I right?
No. First of all, the picture that I'm looking at is in that rectangle above my, where it says John Lear, the Living Moon. See that?
In the rectangle above it?
Yeah. See, it says the Living Moon.
I'm looking, I only see below, John. I don't see the above it. I got one that shows the Earth from the moon's surface and the size of it doesn't. Then I got the full moon in living color. That's the one I thought we were talking about.
No. See,
then we got the living room. Oh, the living moon as you've never seen it.
Yeah, that you got to go back up or back because you got to get to the first page of thelivingmoon.com.
I thought I was there. Tell the truth. But look, tell me more. How can we have technology on the moon if we didn't get there?
It's not us.
Oh.
Anyway. When you get to that picture, that is a nuclear reactor of some sort. And I had that picture taken, and it's gorgeous. And I gave a lecture in San Jose, and one of the guys from Livermore Lawrence Livermore Laboratories came over, and he said, that's very interesting. He said, you know why it's glowing blue? And I said, no. He says, that's called the Cherenkov effect, and that's when radiation hits air.
Now, you know, the Japanese were going to make this rocket pilotless, manless vehicle around orbiting around the moon, and said they were going to take pictures to show, you know, the American flag and all that stuff, and then it went dead silent. I mean, I knew the American government had to reach out and tell them, look, you know, you're not going to find what you think you're going to find.
Yeah, both Cayuga and Selene, the Chinese, got screwed by NASA because somehow NASA talked them into having these guys use our download equipment, and both Cayuga and Selene showed old NASA pictures, old NASA moon pictures.
Oh my God, John! Another form of fakery. Is there no end to it? I can't thank you enough for coming on, John. I want to have you back. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Absolutely sensational, everyone. This is Jim Fetzer, your host. I think today it was a real privilege to listen. Goodbye.